Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. After billions of dollars and a seemingly endless campaign season, President Barack Obama has been reelected. Republicans have maintained control in the House, and Democrats have strengthened their hold on the Senate. In Illinois, Democrats picked up seats in the House and Senate. In Indiana, another Republican will be governor. And in Illinois' 13th congressional district, where nothing has been cut and dry this election season, Republican Rodney Davis appears to have defeated David Gill, but Gill has not yet conceded. In other words, the more things change, the more they stay the same. And yet there were a number of interesting results yesterday. The very red state of Indiana elected a Democrat to the U.S. Senate. A number of politicians who made, well, let's say unusual comments regarding rape this election season went down to defeat. And then there were the ballot initiatives. Here in Illinois, voters rejected a constitutional amendment to make it more difficult to expand public employee retirement benefits. Maine and Maryland have become the first states to approve same-sex marriage by popular vote. And medical use of marijuana has been approved in Massachusetts and rejected in Arkansas. We have two guests with us today to talk about these and other results from Tuesday's election. Brian Gaines is a professor in the Department of Political Science and the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Professor Gaines, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us. Also joining us is John Jackson, visiting professor at the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Professor Jackson, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here with you.
And we welcome your questions and comments as well at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we welcome your questions on our Facebook page. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is willpublicmedia. Gentlemen, I want to start with what was the biggest surprise, the most interesting thing that occurred in yesterday's election and its results, starting with Professor Gaines?
Well, in some ways, this isn't a surprise. The races more or less followed the polls, and I guess the thing that did catch my attention was the U.S. Senate races, the ones that were polling as essentially dead ties and toss-ups, almost all broke in favor of the Democrats. So when you looked at the presidency and the U.S. Senate race, you would conclude it was a very good night for the Democrats and everything went right for them. You have to qualify that once you look at the U.S. House, where we have basically the Republicans losing one or two seats, depending on the final count, but keeping a very healthy majority.
Professor Jackson?
Well, I agree. I think the size and scope of the Democratic victory was more than most people anticipated. And for President Obama to only lose two states that he had carried in 08 really is pretty remarkable. He dropped Indiana and North Carolina, otherwise basically won the same states he had won before. And in 08, he picked up nine states that had gone for Bush in four. So the extent of that victory, as well as the Senate victories, is fairly substantial and a bit surprising.
Professor Gaines, gobs of money were spent on the presidential election, and of course not just by the campaigns themselves. An estimated $1.5 billion was spent by outside parties, super PACs and the like, on this presidential race, and the results were, as Professor Jackson just suggested, pretty much the same as 2008. What lesson, if any, should be drawn from this?
Well, we'll have to wait and see till we get the final accounting and how the spending differential played out. In 2008, Obama substantially outspent John McCain, and that was part of the story. And for people who don't like large amounts of spending, I think Barack Obama gets some of the blame for declining public funding because he realized he could spend because he could raise enough that he could outspend McCain substantially if he didn't take the public money with limits. Citizens United meant that we were going to get even more spending, that decision, and we did, and it's really just a steady upward trend. There is a line of argument that when we complain that there's just too much spending, we're maybe missing the point that politics is extremely important and a heck of a lot of money is spent trying to persuade people to drink Miller Lite or Pepsi or Coke. It isn't really a huge amount compared to the advertising budgets for all the products that are out there. But if you don't like money in politics, you won't be happy with this election and probably won't be happy with the next one either.
Yeah, Professor Jackson, for all the hand-wringing over Citizens United, have we reached maybe a ceiling in terms of how much money can influence elections?
Well, there's always been a limit on how much money can influence elections, but I would say we're not out of the woods yet on the role of the super large amounts of money from the super PACs and from the super rich. Even though they didn't win a great number of races they entered, they still disproportionately funded what happened last night. And my own preferred model would be a lot of people at the grassroots giving relatively small amounts of money and mostly funding House and Senate races, particularly, as well as presidential races. And we've gone further and further away from that ideal, both with the super PACs and in the wake of Citizens United.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing Tuesday's election results with University of Illinois political science professor Brian Gaines from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs and John Jackson, visiting professor at the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. We welcome your questions and comments for our guests at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. And we'll start this morning with Scott. He's on a cell phone. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Craig. I thought I heard you say that the supermajority issue that was on the ballot regarding pension increases in the future had been defeated. This morning in the News Gazette, that issue was tallied as a yes for a pass. So I just kind of wanted clarification on that. I judged for about 100 hours for this election cycle, including early voting, and I've never seen an issue presented in a more confusing way, or certainly one that appeared to be confusing more, particularly young voters, as they entered the poll, although it's fair to say I was at the Union for this, and so there are a lot of young voters there. So could you please give me a little bit of an update on what the situation with that is? Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for the call. Professor Gaines, let's walk through this, because this was rather complicated.
Deeply confusing. We were discussing earlier, on top of everything else, about the constitutional language not being on the ballot itself, and people who wanted to be informed reading op-eds that would have said essentially flatly opposite things about what the impact of this was. There's the point that it requires a supermajority, so a majority yes isn't enough. And then there was the ballot placement, which was very unusual. It was on the side of the ballot where it was easy to miss.
Yeah, and it's actually even more complicated than that, because as I understand it, there are two conditions by which it could pass. One is that supermajority, that 60% of voters say yes, and as it turns out, I think it was something like 54% said yes. The other option is that a majority of all of the votes tallied say yes. So even if there's a 54% voting yes, that may not be 54% of everybody that voted, because maybe not everybody actually voted for or against that particular issue.
There is ordinarily a relatively high abstention rate on complicated ballot provisions like this, on constitutional amendments, and I think the placement at the side of the ballot surely will have increased the abstention on it, because it was relatively easy to miss.
Yeah, it was on the left column of the ballot on the front page, and the presidential election was on the right column, sort of near the top of the page, of the front page. And so I could envision a lot of people. In fact, my eyes initially did this. As I voted, I went immediately to the presidential race to vote, and suddenly realized, wait a minute, that's not actually the beginning of the ballot, and figured out, oh, okay, I got to read through all of this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that may have been part of the complication for some folks.
In general, when voters don't understand something, they tend to vote no. And I think there's no question a lot of people just simply did not understand what exactly was at issue with this. And even experts were disagreeing. Does this undercut the constitutional protection of pension rights, or does it not? Who's behind it, and what were their motives? It was a very murky sort of item.
Let's take another call. We have Brian on the line from Champaign. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning. Something that sort of surprised me about us, I'm kind of a political junkie, and so I was following Nate Silver and a series of Real Clear Politics and so forth to see what the numbers were prior to the election. And, you know, essentially the polls were saying that Obama was going to win. He was winning at about 2% if you averaged out the polls right up to the end there, with an exception of a certain period along the way. And Silver said he had a 90.9% chance of winning. He won with, at this point, 2.7 million votes more than his rival. Bush in 2004 won by about 2.5%, Obama by 2.2% at this point, and 332 votes is way over what Bush had at 286. So as NPR said this morning, it's an electoral landslide, they said. It's funny, no one is saying this. They all say it was a very tiny, eked-out victory. But in fact, he did thread the needle, admittedly, and it was a brilliant campaign, but it was an electoral landslide, and I don't see why the mass media is trying to avoid that, except to try to paint this as if, you know, Bush has to, Obama has to go across the aisle and try to work with Mitchell McConnell and so forth. I think it's actually kind of the other way, right? The Republicans had a terrible night, and I don't see how you could slice it any other way, essentially, because they really didn't pick up anything, and they barely held on to the House of Representatives.
All right. Thanks for the comments. Professor Jackson, what do you think?
Well, I think the polling industry in general, with two or three exceptions, won last night, and certainly Nate Silver won last night. If it had gone the other way, there had been an awful lot of explaining to do and perhaps some pollsters looking for a new line of work. But with the exception of Rasmussen and maybe Gallup, everyone seemed to me to be pretty consistent. It was a consistent 1 to 2 point gap for the last 2 weeks at least, and Nate Silver was absolutely consistent all the way along, and what they predicted basically came true last night.
Professor Gaines, when we talk about media coverage of particularly the ramp up to this election and any other election, if we include the pundits, within that overarching umbrella of media and sort of set aside the reporters that actually, report on the data, but just talk about the people who sort of are part of the industry of offering opinions about elections. Isn't it in their best interest to couch any election as being really close up to the end?
There's an incentive to drive up the interest in the election, and that means to make it seem suspenseful. I don't really think there was a great deal of that going on this time. In the end, the Electoral College is designed in part to inflate popular vote in margins, and it seems to have done that. I guess we'll wait and see on the final call in Florida, but I wouldn't say that a lot of pretty tight, maybe not quite razor thin, but very thin wins in a lot of states that produce extra electoral votes is itself a decisive mandate. It's a great night for the Democrats in the U.S. Senate race in particular, and Obama was playing in some respects quite a weak hand in terms of the state of the economy, and he won, and I wouldn't take that away from him. But the one sense which I disagree with the caller is I don't know that there's any deliberate attempt to downplay the size of the win. In the end, if the popular vote's quite tight and the electoral vote less tight, that's normal.
Let's go next to David. He's on a cell phone. David, good morning.
Good morning. I just want to follow through on that same thought, but think a little bit more about the long term. You had Obama running in a quite poor economy and with a relatively mixed record with a number of initiatives that were not popular, such as Obamacare. In the long run, as we come out into 2016 and beyond, it strikes me that the Democrats are very well poised during a period when most people are expecting the economy to be rebounding to really try to lock in and secure gains made in this election and help secure a legislative agenda such as Obamacare for a long-term victory along those fronts. Be interested to hear your response.
All right, thanks for the call. Professor Gaines, what do you think about the long-term implications of the results last night?
I'm always wary of long-term predictions. In 2008, a lot of people thought they saw the return of Democratic dominance. They retook the U.S. House with a big margin, and they thought this period of Republicans controlling the House that we had from 1994 onward is over. We're back to normal politics. The Democrats had the House for 40 years before that, and then it was gone again in two more years. And we're at a phase right now where we've had a lot of volatility from the last couple of elections, from 2006 onward. I would agree there are some good signs for the Democrats in terms of having won a race that looked quite losable, and I give a lot of credit to the Obama campaign having made a series of very good decisions. But I, for people who think there's a demographic destiny here, the Republicans simply can't win, that kind of prediction has been made before, and they tend not to be right.
Professor Jackson?
Well, that being said, the Republicans can certainly win again and will win again, but there will be an enormous amount of soul-searching and internal bickering within the Republican Party over these results and what the trends indicate for them. Most notably, Hispanic voters are growing, and the Republicans lost disastrously among Hispanic voters and women voters, particularly unmarried women voters, just an enormous gender gap there. Obviously, Democrats have a white male gender gap of their own to worry about, but while demographics may not be destiny, it's certainly a trend that has to be considered by the Republican Party.
you know, my one sort of rebuttal to that is that all of these things were true in 2008, and we still saw a smashing Republican win in 2010. It's easy to overread the degree to which demographics favor your party. And I think that was part of the story of the beginning of the Obama administration, and that was we saw a midterm backlash. Generally, we see midterm losses. It's entirely possible that 2 years from now we'll be talking about the pendulum swinging right back again, Republicans making gains.
Well, that's true, but the size of the electorate and the shape of the electorate in the midterms 2010 is dramatically smaller and different from the presidential race electorate, as you know, and obviously you've got to factor that in terms of long-term ability of the parties to prosper.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guests are John Jackson, visiting professor at the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale, and political science professor Brian Gaines from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. We're discussing Tuesday's election results, and we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Our Twitter handles Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's move on now to the Illinois congressional results. We saw Democrats picking up some seats. And Professor Gaines, how much of this has to do with redistricting?
It's a great deal that has to do with redistricting. As soon as Pat Quinn won the governor's election, Bill Brady lost, and it was clear that the Democrats would draw the map entirely alone. They got to essentially gerrymander unimpeded. We knew they would be able to reverse the 2010 Republican gains in the U.S. House seats, and they did it extremely skillfully. They drew a map that featured four races that were rated to be toss-ups that were clearly winnable either way, and they took three of them. Looks like, assuming that, although David Gill has not conceded, if Rodney Davis holds this seat, this will be the one exception, but you know, it isn't entirely a matter of the people of Illinois having swung to the left of the Democratic Party here. This was a map that, in some respects, couldn't fail. The state lost a seat. The Democrats were bound to gain some, and they did everything they could to draw incumbents away from the voters who knew them and to and sort of mix up the normal vote so that there were these seats that would be winnable for good Democratic candidates, and then they pulled it off.
Professor Jackson, why do you think maybe the 13th District was the exception to the rule? Or appears to be?
Well, I agree with the assessment. For starters, the 13th was just such an odd district, and, you know, stretches from what, Champaign all the way to the Mississippi River, and was a totally different and artificial district. All districts are artificial, but that one was a strange, and while it was contiguous, it was hardly compact. So that one was kind of the wild card in the crowd. Could have gone either way. If the more moderate Democrat had won the primary, probably would have been closer, may have gone the other way. We had an interesting one here in the 12th, which is where I live, and that was Jerry Costello retiring at a late moment, and then the Democrats basically having a candidate who won the primary drop out on them, and Democrats didn't even get their candidate until the first week in June, and still Bill Inyart is the new congressman from Southern Illinois today.
You know, and that's interesting because it's a very similar situation with the 13th District with Rodney Davis seemingly at a competitive disadvantage by sort of, you know, by being selected by party leadership to run in the campaign and replace retiring Congressman Tim Johnson on the ballot, but with, you know, with less time to campaign. Could it be that those are actually competitive advantages?
Well, it turned out not to be a mortal wound for the Democrats. They settled on a candidate that was a very strong candidate. He had been the adjutant for the Illinois National Guard, a two-star general, deep roots in the district, a graduate of SIU Carbondale's Law School, and so forth. So,
and this is William Inyart.
This is Inyart, who just won over Jason Plummer, who ran, of course, for lieutenant governor with Bill Brady and lost that one, now lost this one in a fairly close but five-point race. And your analogy is exactly right. That was the point I was trying to make. The 13th and the 12th faced exactly the same circumstance, disadvantage to the Republicans on one side, disadvantage to Democrats on the 12th district side, and yet both prevailed.
Let's take some more calls. We have Richard on the line from Urbana. Richard, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I have two questions, a short one and a broader one, a related question. The first question had to do with who, they both deal with super PACs. The question is, was it a super PAC which ran the ad in Ohio, which suggested that Jeep was going to move its manufacturing operations to China, which had the effect of mobilizing the base of the Democratic Party in Ohio, especially in the labor belt in the north. And if that's true, and I'm not sure that it is, it raises a broader question about whether super PAC advertising, if they're not controlled closely by the political the parties that are running the things, can actually be dysfunctional, engage in some advertising which turns out to be counterproductive towards the purposes and the interests of the candidates that are supposedly being benefited by it.
It's a great question. Thank you very much for posing it. Professor Gaines, a lot of political watchers sort of rolled their eyes over the course of the last year or two as the super PAC ads came along, and then the candidates would say, oh, well, we can't coordinate with them, so we have no control over what they're saying. But in fact, in some cases, I'm sure there are some ads where the candidates really wish those ads weren't running.
Yeah.
If they're supposed to benefit them.
The second part of that question is the easier part. I think there's no question that the sort of open wild, wild west for advertising has pros and cons for candidates, and they can get ads that are run on their behalf that they're not crazy about. This isn't actually brand new. I would remind people the Willie Horton ads in the 1988 campaign were not run by the George H.W. Bush campaign. They were third-party ads. He had an ad on crime that was the revolving door ad that showed prisoners going into a prison and out the same door, but it wasn't the infamous Willie Horton ad, and that was not a Bush campaign ad. So it's always been true that supporting groups are able to run ads. The non-coordination provisions in the law are virtually unenforceable and almost never enforced in any case. So it's basically a free world, and the existence of YouTube has made it even more true that things that basically look like ads that don't have to run on the air at all can still get a great deal of attention. And, it is a double-edged sword. It can be good or bad for candidates to have their supporters out there putting out what they want, the message they want.
Professor Jackson?
Well, I agree with that. I think the listener's point, the larger point, is a very good one. There are lots of crazy things that get put into those ads, and the crazier stuff goes into the PAC ads and the supposedly independent, non-coordinated ads. That being said, my understanding is that the Romney campaign and the governor himself explicitly embraced that ad, endorsed it, and defended its accuracy. So if that is correct, then, you know, there's not a huge distinction there. They might have tried to hold it at arm's length, but it's my understanding they not only didn't do that, they actively defended it.
Let's go next to Sheila. Sheila is in Urbana. Good morning. Welcome to the show.
I'm interested in guest has been saying about the 13th district and that it was at a disadvantage to Republicans. Maybe so, but there was some immoral things going on with negative ads from out of state to David Gill, got that huge amounts of money. And David Gill is, you know, if anything, you know, a bootstrap candidate, and he came in very close this time to the Republican, but it was negative and misleading ads that said things like Gill voted for this or Gill supported that. Well, Gill wasn't even in office. Gill couldn't have voted for any of those things. There are many distortions and lies in those ads, and so it makes me wonder if Romney, the Republican candidate, really won fairly, or did he win because people lied? And I think it's a grave concern. I know it's not just in this 13th, but these things happen. I also was under the impression that Mr. The Republican candidate had been in the primary before Tim Johnson decided to retire. And I feel very betrayed and I feel like I'm going to have to live in a district where lying is the way that people get what they want.
All right. Thanks very much for the call and the comments. One of the questions that we asked a few folks prior to Election Day, as we saw the sort of ramp up of negative ads, in not just in this race, but in lots of races, was whether or not these negative ads actually work. Do they convince anyone? What do you think, Professor Gaines?
Political science really ought to know the answer to this question by now. There's been a huge amount of work on it for more than 20 years. To the extent that there's an agreement, people agree they seem to suppress turnout a little bit. In a sufficiently negative campaign, swing voters, moderates, and independents in the middle, some of them will end up staying away. They end up persuaded both candidates are not worth supporting. But I think campaign officials, campaign consultants strongly believe if the other side goes negative, you must respond. It's they always want to throw the last punch, and they believe you can't let yourself be covered with mud without throwing some back. So the candidate still, when an ad campaign goes negative on one side, you almost always see it go negative on both sides. That's my impression of the 13th this time. It was very negative both ways. And I wish I could tell you political science has absolutely nailed down if it does or doesn't work, but there are reputable, careful studies on both sides that would lead to that sort of reach opposite conclusions.
Professor Jackson, what do you think? Do negative ads work?
Yeah, I agree with all of that, what he just said. It depends on what the definition of work is, of course. I think there's some indication that people do learn from the ads, and they do have at least a mental agenda partially set by those ads. Unfortunately, the facts contained in are often not only not facts, they're complete untruths in some cases. But they work to the extent that lots of people get elected after having run extraordinarily nasty negative campaigns against an opponent. And in that sense, the operatives out there believe they work.
We're taking your questions and comments about yesterday's election for University of Illinois political science professor Brian Gaines from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs and John Jackson, visiting professor at the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. You can join our conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu, and we'll take more of your phone calls after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, we look back on the election and ahead to the future with Norm Ornstein, who's written about election reform to make voting easier, campaign finance reform, and how the Republican Party moved far to the right. He's the co-author of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's programming is made possible by Parkland College Theater, presenting An Evening of Short Plays, The Actor's Nightmare, and Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind, 30 plays in 60 minutes, from November 14th through 18th. More information is available at 351-2528.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're discussing Tuesday's election results with John Jackson, visiting professor at the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale, and political science professor Brian Gaines from the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. To join our conversation and share your thoughts on the election, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. WILL, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Next up is Gary in Decatur. Gary, welcome to the show.
Hi. I was just wondering, I know you've covered this, but I was confused by the answer. The amendment to increase the voting majority to increase the voting percentage to raise pensions, did that pass or did it not pass?
It did not pass.
It did not pass. Okay. That's all I wanted.
All right. Thanks for the call. But let's talk about pensions, gentlemen, because one of the implications maybe of not that much changing at the State House and not that much changing in Congress, other than seats shifting a little bit, but the balance of power staying the same, just maybe solidifying. Is there any reason to believe, Professor Gaines, that we're going to see pensions dealt with at the State House effectively, or that we're going to see debt dealt with effectively in Congress?
I'd love to say yes. I don't really know what it is. The fact is, at some point, Illinois is going to be in such serious fiscal trouble that the legislature will have to deal seriously with the pension liabilities. Illinois is, by different rankings, either the worst or the second worst state in the country in terms of its fiscal condition, the structural deficits, the pension liabilities. When you take into account the liabilities at the city and municipal level that could end up in the state's hands, it only California might be in equally bad shape. And this legislature has done pretty much all the kind of gimmicky things it can do to generate revenue and cut expenditures in less painful ways, leasing the lottery, for instance. One of these days we're going to have to address it, and I don't know when bond markets are going to decide the state. We've already been downgraded, but I don't know when they'll give up on Illinois and think this is a dysfunctional state that cannot get its house in order, and it can't be treated as a serious as a creditor. But in the meanwhile, if I shift to the federal federal government, I think we see the same kind of very, very serious fiscal problems and not a lot of basis for thinking things will be different with the Republicans controlling the House and this president who's gone on terribly with House Republicans. I don't know why I would expect them to suddenly see the light and compromise.
Professor Jackson?
I think the General Assembly will do something probably in January. The question is whether they do it in the so-called lame duck session, which is the easiest way of doing it, or wait until the new session comes on board. Pensions and paying for them have become so big and so problematic, it's toxic. And the question is whether or not the Democrats will demand some votes from the Republicans in order to get it done. My guess is the Speaker of the House will want some Republican votes, and the test will be, can he round up some of those votes? If he can't, he may do it in the lame duck session. If he can, he would prefer, I would think, to do it after the new session convenes.
Professor, go ahead.
I just want to make one point about pensions that, in a sense, they're a scapegoat. It's a little bit unfair. The pension system is designed in such a way that it's not fiscally stable. But it's because past governments decided to take a pension holiday and not to fund it that the pension liabilities have gotten so far out of hand. Had they not already made some decisions basically shifting costs into the future, the pensions wouldn't stand out against other structural deficits. The truth is the state has an awful fiscal situation and chose to concentrate the debt in a certain area. And so it looks like, well, it's all a pensions problem. But the state's problems are deeper than pensions. And in some respects, pensions are just the area where they chose not to pay their bills.
Professor Jackson, there's another challenge that lawmakers in Springfield will have to tackle soon, and that is the establishment of a health exchange. Governor Quinn said he planned to move forward no matter what the results would be, but I'm wondering if President Obama's reelection makes the process of establishing that exchange easier.
Well, I think it does, and I think the governor has got to come to the table now with some kind of a plan. And, of course, if the state doesn't act, then the federal government will establish the national pool and the national exchange. So there is a fallback position. But I would think Illinois would want to get out front. And I think the governor has said that we should be out front. I think he's been waiting on the election, and now it's time to move.
Let's go next to David in Urbana. David, welcome to the show.
Yes, I have a question about the effects of redistricting following 2010. It seems to me that particularly in some of the southern states, Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, the redistricting is such that it magnifies quite considerably the true strength of the conservatives in the in those states. Of course, something of the same sort happened here in Illinois, where the 13th district is, I don't think I'm really exaggerating to call it an abomination, but would you comment on that? And do you see any way that this sort of thing can be remedied?
All right, thanks for the call. Professor Gaines?
In principle, it can be remedied by having nonpartisan mapmakers, having commissions that are composed of people who are neither Democrats nor Republicans and who are forbidden from using political data. That hasn't worked in practice in very many states. Iowa is the favorite example in the United States of a commission that seems to draw relatively fair maps with relatively compact districts. There's no question, though, that in most of the states, the maps, when they're drawn by one party alone, are drawn for the purpose of exaggerating that party's strength, and they're mostly successful. If there's any bright side to it, it's that when parties gerrymander with that particular intention of maximizing their seats, they're always at risk of an election which swings against them coming back and biting them and losing a lot of seats. But I think some of the story of 2012 will be, why did the Republicans do so well in the U.S. House? Partly because they did so well in 2010 and they had more control of more state governments. And with the exception of some big states where courts stepped in, they were able to draw maps that were intended to insulate them. And we saw that in the Democratic side in Illinois.
Professor Jackson, any thoughts?
Well, the listener is quite right about the South. I'm from the South, and I know a bit about what's going on there. And in fact, it's contributed, the gerrymandering, redistricting, both has contributed to two things, the polarization of the parties, because most of the districts now are either white Republican majorities or majority minority, where you get central cities represented by African Americans with a guaranteed safe seat. And the effect of that in the South has been to mostly eliminate sort of the moderate white Democrat. In fact, there's only one or two moderate white Democrats outside cities still left standing, a handful at the most, because of the way in which redistricting works in the South.
The one additional point to make is the Supreme Court has said it can, in principle, strike down maps as being drawn as partisan gerrymanders, but it hasn't yet seen a map that was sufficiently be across the line as a partisan gerrymander to be illegal. The racial gerrymandering that Professor Jackson alluded to is sort of a different animal. It's understood. It's been a very fuzzy and shifting jurisprudence, but basically understood to be required that you draw majority-minority districts. That has the effect of making very safe districts that elect minority Democrats who are very liberal, and then the surrounding districts become safer for Republicans and return conservative Republicans. That's certainly an ingredient in polarization.
We've been talking about Illinois, but let's talk a little bit about Indiana. In the state of Indiana, Democrat Joe Donnelly defeated Republican Richard Murdoch for the U.S. Senate seat, being vacated by Richard Lugar. Murdoch seemed well on his way to victory until that final debate and his controversial statements about pregnancy and rape and God's will. Professor Jackson, to what do you attribute the strange number of, well, let's face it, ill-conceived statements about rape by some politicians in this election cycle?
Well, to some extent, this is the power of the Tea Party and those the Tea Party supported, especially in primaries, particularly the case of Murdoch defeating Richard Lugar. And you get people with, I think, outlier views, and many of them muse about things that many Americans believe are private and theological issues, and when they muse out loud, they often get themselves in trouble with sort of mainstream middle-of-the-road voters, which is what I think happened in Indiana and in Missouri both.
Professor Gaines, to that point, we have an email from Rowana who says, among my friends, almost all self-described moderates, there's a discussion about whether it's time for the Republican Party to split between the Tea Party and social conservatives and the fiscally conservative, socially liberal factions within it. She says, personally, I can't see this happening, though I can definitely see the benefits of such a split and would likely vote for the new fiscally conservative, socially liberal party. What is the real possibility of something like this happening, and what effect would it have on both the Democrat and Republican parties?
Very, very unlikely that we'll see a new party. The American party system is pretty firmly entrenched as a two-party system. The Tea Party movement, which has the confusing aspect that it's got the name party in it, is pretty well now ensconced in the Republican Party. Two points I'd make about this. Todd Akin was not particularly a Tea Party favorite. He's a conservative, and he certainly shot himself in the foot with his comments about rape and abortion. But the Tea Party, I think, really should not be confused with or used as a synonym for people who are socially conservative. There are different strains within the party. And his gaffe is more puzzling because it came after Akin's. You would have thought he would be on guard against it. But if you're thinking the Republicans lost these Senate races because they picked extreme or Tea Party or so excessively conservative candidates, you should look at Wisconsin and Tommy Thompson, who lost, who's much more of a moderate Republican. They lost races with candidates who probably are a little bit too far to the right, but they lost races with candidates who are not. In Ohio, they lost to Sherrod Brown, who's clearly on the left of the Democratic Party, with Josh Mandel, a candidate who's not a right-wing nut. Really, last night, they lost everywhere, and I don't think you can say it was just the case that they lost because they had their primary voters picked Tea Party extremists.
Professor Jackson, we talked about the constitutional amendment proposed on the ballot here in Illinois. There were other ballot initiatives yesterday that were of particular note. Maine and Maryland have become the first states to approve same-sex marriage by popular vote. Is this, in your mind, maybe a major turning point in the national conversation over same-sex marriage?
Well, I think the opinion of the public has been moving and reasonably rapidly in direction of supporting same-sex marriage. It's fairly remarkable that two states have now taken this step, but public opinion has shifted over certainly the last decade, even the last half decade, fairly markedly in that direction.
And Professor Gaines, any surprises regarding some states' ballot initiatives regarding the use of marijuana?
Well, what I like about Washington having voted to legalize it is it wasn't a medical marijuana bill. The medical marijuana has proven to be a mess, frankly. It's pretty openly understood to be a way to legalize marijuana under the cover of pretending that it's medical for a lot of people suddenly proclaiming to have migraines and back pain and other difficult to diagnose problems who are simply eager to use marijuana. I think the whole thing should be done much more openly. It still leaves some confusion about the conflicts between state and federal law, but I think if we want to see some experimentation on how legalization works, it shouldn't be done through this backdoor way of pretending to be medical.
Let's take some more calls. We have Gordon on the line from Champaign. Gordon, welcome to the program.
Yeah, back to the fiscal state of Illinois. You guys said that we're either the worst or maybe slightly above California, depending. What is that going to mean for the individuals, people like myself in Illinois down the road? What's the worst case scenario? I mean, in terms of pocket, you know, out of pocket expenses and bailing out, things like that.
Okay, Professor Jackson, what's this all going to cost us?
Well, I think it will cost state retirees sooner or later. There are, of course, all kinds of trade-offs being considered. The question of what is constitutional, of course, is a big part of this discussion. But beyond what is constitutional on cutting retiree benefits, there's the possibility of retirees paying much more for their health care, retirees having to pay income tax, which they currently do not on retirement income, all kinds of other possible trade-offs. The absolute black hole worst case of all would be that the state can't pay its bills, including its obligations to the pension system people.
The caller asked for the worst case scenario, so I maybe I should go for broke with this. The worst case is the state finally does have to go bankrupt, and we get a really institutional, constitutional case of what happens when a state is bankrupt, and we enter the world that Greece is in now within the European Union. That would mean the state, all state employees get worse services, that the state, by paying, for example, university employees less, ends up with weaker universities, that the state already can't pay its bills and waits a year to pay them and pays a ridiculous interest rate. What's worse than that? The state waits even longer. More providers simply won't do business with the state of Illinois. Businesses leave. It becomes extremely costly for the state of Illinois to loan money, to borrow money. All of these things could well happen.
Let's take another call. We have a caller from the central Illinois town of Belgium. Good morning. Welcome to the show.
Welcome. Good morning to you all. Yes. You just barely touched on a topic that I'd like to bring up, and that's the fact we spent what I've heard from $2 to $6 billion to get exactly the same government we had on Monday. Now, three states have voted for marijuana usage, which seems like a logical thing to me, but at the same time, these laws are in contradiction with federal laws, and I think back in the 1860s we found out that states' rights means very little in these aspects. What in the world did we actually get in this election?
All right. Good question. Professor Gaines?
Well, it's true. We got the status quo back. And if there were a way to make a deal in advance to say no more spending, we're just going to end up with the same government anyway. Let's put all that money towards the deficit. That would be a great thing. There is no such mechanism. So, as I said earlier, people who don't like money in politics won't be happy this time. They're not going to be happy next time. The trend is up. And it's not any one court decision. It's just a long-term trend that more and more money gets spent on every election.
Professor Jackson?
Well, elections about a renewal of license to govern or given the license to govern to someone else. And in this case, it was mostly a renewal of the license to govern. It has to be done constitutionally. There's a lot to be said for doing it and giving new bona fides to those people who have now got to struggle with these very difficult problems. I think $2 billion was an awful high price tag for lots of reasons. That's difficult to control. But I don't think it was in vain that we had this exercise.
If you believe in the stimulus and that government spending is useful, you should be happy that all this money was spent on advertising and this should have boosted the economy. I mean, I think to the extent that people have been buying into a Keynesian model of how to revive the economy, then a whole bunch of spending on the election is in some respect a great thing.
Certainly stimulated the television station revenues.
One thing that we could point to as a potential change, even if the balance of power doesn't change in a given legislative body, the individual people that are elected change over time. Is there anybody that was elected last night, pardon me, that you look at and think, well, this may be a future rising star within politics? Anybody stand out to you, Professor Gaines?
There isn't. I wish I had a better crystal ball and I could tell you this is, I can see the White House in 8 years, and I don't in particular. I do think there are, both parties have relatively young people out there who seem promising and were in most cases reelected. I'm not aware of anyone. The Democrats, I guess, were very pleased with the mayor of San Antonio, who spoke at their convention, and they see him as someone who looks like Barack Obama did in 2004. But I nobody jumped out at me in from election returns.
All right, Professor Jackson?
I think Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts is already a star and clearly a rising star. If you give her a Senate seat, she will be a force in some ways, I say, possibly comparable to Hillary Clinton when she was in the Senate. I'd keep an eye on her.
Since we began the hour with the theme of the more things change, the more they stay the same, I should mention one other item before we wrap up. The former judge ousted for refusing to remove a Ten Commandments monument won his old job back as Alabama's Chief Justice. Republican Roy Moore defeated Democrat Bob Vance. You may recall Roy Moore became known as Alabama's Ten Commandments judge back in 1995. The ACLU sued him to remove a homemade plaque of the Ten Commandments from the lobby of the state judicial building. The Alabama Supreme Court threw out the suit, but the legal battle helped him win the race for Chief Justice in 2000. Well, then a state court for judges kicked him out of office 3 years later when he refused to abide by a federal judge's order to remove the monument, and now he's back. There are figures in politics, Professor Gaines, who... they come, they go, they come back.
There are. We have figures who've been arrested and then reelected in the Illinois House. We have
Derek Smith.
Derek Smith. So, you know, for better or for worse, the United States is a system that's very pro democracy. We vote for a lot of things, and in a lot of countries, the judges are not elected, but. We've embraced majoritarianism in the sense that we elect an awful lot of offices. That's why the ballots are so long, and it's a relatively arduous task to vote. And you can always appeal to people and get your job back.
Professor Jackson, does anyone anywhere from President Obama to local office holders have any sort of clear mandate from voters?
Yes, they have a mandate to take power and try to govern, which is the most important mandate of all. They've, of course, got the very difficult challenge to get compromise. In the president's case, what happens particularly with the House Republicans is absolutely crucial, and he will have, I think, a renewed license to go and try to bargain with them. I'm not encouraged by what they've been saying yesterday and today, because they're saying basically that they will not bargain on the issue of a tax increase for people over $250,000. But that conversation's got to play out.
We have just a few moments left. Let me just ask each of you, how do you think the media handled last night's election results and how they covered it? Have we learned our lessons from 2000?
Well, perhaps. We don't have any cases of really trigger-happy calls on states or ignoring the norm that you don't call a state until all of the polls have closed. That's all for the better. But it turned out to be a fairly easy election to call in that respect. So the real test is when you end up with another case of 2000, something this was fairly close but not close enough to be a really serious test.
Professor Jackson?
I thought they were remarkably sophisticated and restrained and pretty much all on the same page. Certainly no scandals came out of that coverage. It was the most complex assessment I've ever seen, and right on target, as it turns out.
John Jackson is a visiting professor at the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Professor Jackson, thanks for talking with us today.
Surely.
And Brian Gaines is a professor in the Department of Public Department of Political Science and the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Professor Gaines, thank you for being with us as well.
I enjoyed it.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, a conversation with historian David Harvey. He's a distinguished professor from the Graduate Center at SUNY and director of the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics. He's also a leading theorist in the field of urban studies. Library Journal calls him one of the most influential geographers of the later 20th century, and he's in town to give a lecture tomorrow night for the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities. David Harvey will be our guest on Thursday. Then on Friday's show, we will talk with musician and researcher Stephen Wade about his book, The Beautiful Music All Around Us, Field Recordings and the American Experience. Wade has appeared occasionally on All Things Considered with commentaries on folk songs and traditional tunes. In his new book, Wade researches field recordings at the Library of Congress, which date back to the 1930s. He tracks down surviving performers and their families and fellow musicians to craft profiles of these long-forgotten performers and their music. We'll hear some of that music and talk about the process of trying to bring largely unheralded musicians of the past into the present. That's on Friday's program. I hope you can tune in for that. A reminder that you can hear this program twice every weekday at 10 a.m. Central Time here on WILL AM 580, and then again weeknights at 8 o'clock Central Time on AM 580. Let anyone know who maybe isn't able to listen to this program when it broadcasts live that we do have that evening rebroadcast. Today's program was produced by Travis Stanzel. Kyle Mabry's our technical director. He handled your calls. I'm Craig Cohen.